Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument for petitioner in Christian versus Sepulveda.
May it please the court. Ms. Lisa Powell is an argument for petitioner. Petitioner may reserve 5 minutes of rebuttal. Good morning. This is a medical malpractice case. The critical fact in this case is the fact that the sole damages alleged by the plaintiff stem directly from the loss of their unborn child. This court must address, I believe, two issues. First of all, whether or not the pleadings in this case allege anything substantively different than the pleadings in the Patilla versus Price case that this court, the opinion in which was handed down last year. If not, then this court must also consider whether or not the trial court erred in denying the plaintiff's leave to amend their petition at that time. Let me address the first issue, and that is whether or not the plaintiff's pleadings in this case allege anything substantively different than the pleadings in the Cride case decided by this court. I believe that they do not. The Cride case does raise a question, or at least leave open a question, of what the legal result would be in the event that a plaintiff alleged a breach of a duty owed directly to the plaintiff mother in the case. But that is not the sole issue or the sole basis why the issue is left open in the Crites' opinion. This court in footnote 2 says, the Crites have failed to allege there is negligent treatment of Jill Crites, and critically the court goes on to say, causing physical injury or mental anguish damages to her. And it is that last issue that we also do not have in this case. There simply are no allegations here of any damages to Mrs. Sepulveda or Mr. Sepulveda, independent of those directly associated with loss of the unborn child. The plaintiff's original petition here alleges in paragraph 4 that the plaintiff developed a condition known as preeclampsia. That, in essence, according to Stavins Medical Dictionary, is hypertension along with protein in the urine or swelling or edema. It is not something that necessarily causes harm to the mother. As in paragraph 5 of their petition, they allege that as a direct and proximate result of the defendant's negligence, plaintiff's daughter, Patricia Sepulveda, died, and plaintiffs have been caused to suffer severe mental pain, anguish, grief, and sorrow. Additionally, plaintiffs have been caused to suffer the loss of society, companionship, and affection of their daughter, Patricia Sepulveda, deceased. So again, we have a situation where the only damages that are claimed by the plaintiff in the original petition, and also for that matter in the amended petition that they sought to file, are those that this court in Price held were not recoverable under the wrongful death statute. The only issue then is whether or not the mere fact that there is a physician-patient relationship here makes a difference. It is our contention that it does not under the facts of this case. Of course, there would also have been a physician-patient relationship in the Crites' opinion. The doctor there, again, was treating the mother there of necessity before the child was born. The issue then becomes, I believe, whether or not the plaintiffs could have alleged a different cause of action. And I don't believe that they could have, because I don't believe that under the common law of this state or under any statute that mental anguish damages are recoverable or should be recoverable for the loss of a fetus. The common law does not support that result. The case most often cited for the proposition that mental anguish damages are recoverable in such a situation is Hill versus Kimball, a very early 1890 Texas Supreme Court case. In that opinion, this court discussed the fact that the plaintiff had witnessed a brawl, a fight, in which the defendant engaged. And the plaintiff there alleged that she miscarried because of the fight, but critically, the plaintiff there made additional allegations. The plaintiff alleged that because of the defendant's actions, those actions otherwise seriously impaired her health. So the damages involved, or the cause of action involved in the Hill versus Kimball decision, was not solely that of a miscarriage of the plaintiff. And in holding that the plaintiff could state a claim there, for certain damages. This court did not hold that there was a cause of action in and of itself for causing a miscarriage or for causing loss of a fetus. Critically, the Hill v. Kimball court did not talk about or make any effort to overrule an earlier decision by this court in Western Union v. Cooper, an 1888 case. That case involved the failure to deliver a telegram summoning a doctor to assist in the plaintiff's labor. The telegram wasn't delivered, the doctor did not come, the woman lost the baby. This court held in that case that the mother could recover her independent damages, that is, anything that's directly related to injury or pain that the mother suffered independent of the loss of the fetus. If there was a prolongation of labor, for example, or some other physical injury directly to the mother. But this court specified recovery based upon the loss of the fetus itself, saying we do not think that the death of the child before birth and the grief or sorrow occasioned thereby can be an element of damages in this character of suit. If it is made to appear from the testimony that Mrs. Cooper suffered more physical pain, mental anxiety, and alarm on account of her own condition, then she could recover that particular damage. But this court, I believe, very clearly held that there was no cause of action for loss of the fetus itself. Those damages simply do not relate to a cause of action for which the plaintiff could recover at that time. I don't believe that there has been a change in the Texas common law since that time. You might argue that under the tort of negligent infliction of emotional distress, that damages of these types could be recovered. This court, however, has held that that cause of action does not exist. And I don't believe that under other case law that this is the type of situation in which those damages should be recovered. This court in Whitty...
We held unless there's a breach of some other legal duty, those damages aren't recoverable.
In that case, Your Honor, there would have to be some other independent tort, some breach of other duty. A tort normally incurs not only breach of the duty but also damages. It is not, except in libel or slander or certain other exceptions, you must have damages in order to have a complete tort. Here, there are no damages other than those in question, that is, from the loss of the baby. Extending this court's decision in Boyles to its farthest point, I believe, there might be recovery if the plaintiff had proven and had alleged, in this case, any damages to herself independent of those that are at issue here. Critically, in this case, however, there is no such allegation, and I believe that there were no such damages.
Let me ask you, I don't mean to interrupt your answer. Are you finished?
Yes, sir.
In that regard, this rather strange sentence in the Court of Appeals opinion, referring to, at the very end of the discussion of mental anguish, which I'm sure you're familiar, where they refer to her suffering as a result of the death of her fetus as a part of the injury to her own body and possibly in addition to other injuries to her body. Were there any allegations in her petition that appeared to conform with that description by the Court of Appeals?
I believe that the only allegation in the petition, in the original petition, is that the plaintiff suffered from preeclampsia. That, again, as I've described, is hypertension combined with protein in the urine or possibly some swelling. That, I believe, is the only allegation in the petition. The amended petition goes on to try to state bystander cause of action and also alleges that the plaintiff suffered from a low level of fluid, amniotic fluid. But there's no allegation, I believe, in either petition of any damages to Mrs. Sepulveda other than those directly stemming from the loss of the fetus. The key paragraph 5, I believe, is the same or virtually the same in both petitions. That is the paragraph that sets out their damages, and those are mental anguish from the death of their daughter and loss of the daughter's society and companionship. I believe that is the case in both situations.
Would you consider the time that the mother carried a stillborn baby as part of her mental anguish damages?
not unless the mother otherwise continues or suffers some injury. I believe that under the Hill case, unless this court extends, rather, under the Cooper case, unless this court extends Cooper because of the Boyles decision, the mother would not have any recovery at all. But even under this court's Boyles decision, that is, reading it in its most liberal posture, I don't believe that that would be the case, absent some independent physical damages to the mother.
How do you reconcile that answer with the answer you gave earlier, with the response you gave earlier about extension or prolongation of labor as a result of some negligence? I've inferred from what you had said earlier that if there was some prolongation of labor or some other complication that results in harm to the mother, separate from the death of the fetus, that that would be recoverable. And yet, as I understood your answer to Judge Spector, a woman who carries a stillborn fetus could not recover for her mental anguish as a result of that situation.
If I understood Judge Spector's question correctly, we're not talking about any extra time other than would ordinarily be involved in a pregnancy or any other physical damage to the mother independent of that. When you talk about the prolongation of labor that's mentioned in the Cooper decision or that's mentioned in some of the decisions of some of the other states, you're talking about something that would have happened to the mother independent of what otherwise would have happened. She would have carried the baby anyway, and that was the reason for my answer to Judge Spector's decision.
Do you think there would be a recovery for a prolongation of labor?
If it was above and beyond that which the mother otherwise would have had to gone through. I might mention that I think that there are a range of solutions for this problem. The one which we would support is that which I believe is consistent with the common law of this case enunciated in Cooper, and that is that there should be no recovery for the mental anguish of the mother. Alternately, even if this court wishes to extend the Boyles decision, then even under that rationale, it would appear that the mother would have to suffer some independent tort, some independent damages, in order for her to recover for the mental anguish, and that has not been alleged here. There are alternatives in other states. For example, the Burgess versus Superior Court California case that this court cited in the Boyles decision, I believe that there are some problems with the analysis of that case, and I don't believe that it is consistent with Texas law. The bottom line is that when you have the situation that the only and the sole damages alleged here are the loss of the fetus itself, I don't believe that there is any available avenue of remedy or damages or any cause of action that would allow recovery for mental anguish. We know that it's not recoverable under the wrongful death statute under this court's Price decision. At least under the common law prior to Boyles, it was not recoverable under Cooper. And even if you give Boyles an expansive interpretation, which we would argue should not be done, but even in that case, the mother would still have to suffer, I believe, some independent tort other than loss of the baby itself in order for there to be compensable damages.
Okay, Ms. Powell, let me ask. If the mother is assaulted in some way, and the only results of the assault is to kill the baby in the womb, you say that that isn't a sufficient tort for the mother to have recovery because the only damages to the mother is the mental anguish resulting from the loss of the baby. Do I understand your position?
Under the Cooper case, I believe that that is correct. Given a broad language of this court's decision in Boyles, I don't believe that that is correct, because when you say assault, I don't believe that as a matter of tort law there can be an assault without some other damages to the mother itself.
Well, so, if you concede, if that, following up with your position, that's your position, doesn't the pleadings in this case claim a negligence conduct negligent on the mother, and the mother therefore suffering damages? Aren't you kind of splitting hairs a little bit? If you're really saying there's no tort here because the only damages she claims is mental anguish as a result of the loss of the fetus, although you acknowledge that she has claimed the negligence was as to the mother. Just simply because the only damage she has is this, we don't recognize it as tort.
I think this court is forced to split hairs in a number of situations, but the bottom line is yes. Under Cooper, I don't think there would be recovery in your assault situation. Under Broyles, and perhaps assault is a bad example. Under assault, I don't think you can have assault without some contact with the mother and some other damage to her. But if for some reason the only allegation of loss there that was made in a particular pleading, or the only claim that was made, I'm not sure that that would even state a cause of action for assault as I understand it. But if that were the case, and the only damages that a plaintiff chose to plead from that assault were the loss of the baby, then I don't think there would be recovery there. Because even under an expansive definition of Broyles, I think you have to have a tort independent of the mental anguish, a tort that would otherwise be established.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, David Nagel will present argument to the
May it please the court. In Witte, this court said, and I quote, medical and funeral expenses of the fetus are expenses incurred by the mother as a direct result of her injury. Of course, in Witte, there was a physical injury which caused the loss of the fetus. In syllabus 4 of Witte, the court also said, the mental anguish suffered as a result of the loss of her fetus is barred under the Workers' Compensation Act. The mental anguish suffered by Mrs. Witte is a part of the injury suffered as a result of the accident. Well, if you look at our pleadings, and I'll have to apologize for very unartful pleadings, the Crawford Amendment was rejected, and the pleadings are not as complete as I would like to see them. On the other hand, it is enough. The pleadings themselves say this. As a direct and proximate result of the defendant's negligence, plaintiff's daughter, Patricia Sepulveda, died, and plaintiffs have been caused to suffer severe mental pain, anguish, grief, and sorrow. The operative word there is and. And is a conjunctive word in the grammar of the English language. And means also, in addition to. The conjunctive use of and gets us past if in fact there is no cause of action for the death of this unborn child.
Do you accept that?
Well, it puts the court in a terribly logically inconsistent position, because if the child is injured in utero and is born alive but damaged, why, of course, the child then continues and has a right of action, and we have those actions all the time. If the doctor commits sufficient malpractice so that the child is injured to the point of death, then there is no right of action. So the logical inconsistency of that just really is appalling.
You're urging us then to overrule our decision from earlier this year in Kreitz and our decision in Blackman against Langford in 1990 and our decision in Witte?
And Lobdell.
And Lobdell.
You know, the difference is that you don't need to overrule those decisions. You really need to reclassify this. If I have just a moment to refresh your recollection about what happens when at 14 to 16 weeks this fetus quickens and the heartbeat starts and circulation is there and there's a nervous system. And the mother knows that the child is a living, breathing, viable piece of tissue within her. Fetus is a medical word. It's an unborn child and growing. The young sibling putting his hand or her hand on the mommy's tummy knows there's a baby in there. Everybody knows there's a baby in there. Everybody knows what's happening. You get ready for it. You get the room ready. You can take pictures of it. You know the sex. You get the name. You make plans to deny that this is a unborn child and called by another name and say it doesn't have any rights is just to fly in the face of what everybody commonly knows.
So you are, in fact, urging us to overrule all of those decisions?
No, what you only, the only thing you have to do, the only thing you have to do is look at this in the same way and analogize it to the loss of a limb. Phantom pain in the loss of a limb is acknowledged as something that is real. It is anguish. It is because of loss of living tissue of the body. All you have to say is that we have living tissue of this mother which has been destroyed by negligence, and as a consequence there has been the usual kinds of pain, suffering, inconvenience, and incidental expenses that come with other types of loss of tissue. If a person can sue for loss of a finger and develop mental anguish to a jury for the loss of that finger, and there is loss, and there is anguish, and there is a sense of grief for the loss of any tissue. Psychologists testify to this all the time. There's a period of grief for the loss of any part of the tissue of anybody for a normal human being. That's just something that happens.
Is there any tissue of Ms. Sepulveda or any part of her body that you have alleged was injured other than the fetus?
No, we have not. I have to confess that there...
So in the Court of Appeals talks about as a part of the injury to her body or other injuries to her body, that can only refer to the fetus.
Realistically, that would be true. That would be what the proof will show.
And while every parent has enjoyed the joy of what you referred to with reference to the expectancy of a child being born, there really is no way we can liken that to the loss of a limb without being inconsistent with about three or four opinions of this court, is there?
I have to say that's right. That's okay. Right.
Mr. Nagel, if we were to take your invitation and we could not distinguish or just put another label about and analogize the fetus to a limb, and we would have to overrule Taylor versus Christ and Lyman versus Langford and Witte and Lobdell, what would be the implications on abortion if that were the case?
Do you mean negligent abortion?
Any abortion.
Any abortion. Well, to be consistent, to be logically and medically consistent, the death of a fetus is in fact the death of a fetus. If it's invited by the mother, I suppose you get into some difficult problems in deciding if there is any responsibility on the part of the mother toward anyone else for the death of a part of her own tissue. I'm not at that point, and I can't go tell you that I've gone forward in my thinking to offer any ideas that I might have about that.
You brought this suit on behalf of Umberto and Olga Sepulveda.
That's true.
And so each has an independent and separate claim. You could have brought it just for Umberto, I suppose.
I believe I could have.
And so if the facts were slightly different and Olga had a hand in the decision to abort this child and to terminate this fetus, then the law that you're asking us to adopt would allow an action by Umberto against her?
Well, I'm not sure that I go that far. When we're talking, well, obviously a fetus, obviously an unborn child, I'd rather use that term. An unborn child is a unique situation, and it is not the limb that, the analogy is not as good as I would like it to be. Nonetheless, it is under the control of the mother, and I think that everybody at this point has recognized in the controversy about abortion that, in fact, the mother does have the right to make certain decisions about her body. At least, I think most people have agreed to that. There's some that don't.
Counsel, if we were to recognize a element or a cause of action for emotional distress, mental anguish for the mother, for loss of the fetus, I think in response to Justice Gonzalez said that there might somehow conflict with the woman's right to terminate her pregnancy under the federal constitution, but I just want to ask you, she would own the right to the cause of action, I presume, under those circumstances, and no one else would.
Her husband's right would be derivative.
Well, that assumes that we would recognize the husband's right, I guess, under the Wrongful Death Act or under some other basis.
Some other basis.
But on the basis, at least, that you argued that in the beginning that she has a right to recover from mental anguish for damage to her own flesh and tissue, that would not necessarily follow that the husband would have any right on that basis to recover, would it?
Are we talking now abortion, or are we talking about negligently causing the death of the unborn child?
If the only element of recovery that you're asking us to recognize here under our common law powers is the right of the mother to mental anguish damages for loss of the fetus, then that would not, it seems to me, and I'd like to get your reaction, collide with the woman's constitutional right to terminate her pregnancy.
No, I don't think it would collide at all.
Because if she would own the cause of action for mental anguish if you wanted to get down to that, and presumably she would not bring suit against herself. And so can you think of any reason why recognition of this element of damage would collide with the woman's right to terminate a pregnancy under the federal constitution?
Well, I apologize for not having carried my thoughts far enough to include what you were asking me here, but I follow your logic, and I think there is no reason that there would be a conflict.
Under what logic, to pursue Justice Cornyn's question further, under what logic would we recognize a cause of action for the death of a fetus to the mother but not to the father?
Well, I think that the mother's participation in the decision would make a distinguishing characteristic that would eliminate the father's rights.
Well, the Whitty case, of course, was largely a case of statutory interpretation.
Right.
The statute defines who can bring an action. Just as you have alleged an action here for both the father and the mother.
Right.
Isn't the legislature then the appropriate place in view of our interpretation of Whitty and in the other cases that we referenced, the place to define a new cause of action for death to a fetus?
Well, I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is that the legislature has defined, or at least the court in Lobdell and the subsequent cases that which affirmed that, in effect said that the fetus is not defined as a person that is within the legislative definition of those people who can sue under the Wrongful Death Act.
Right.
So all you have to do is say that the fetus is not such a person. You've already said that. The fetus isn't a person until it's born. Okay, it isn't, but it is a part of the tissue of the mother. And when that tissue is caused to die, you can just say that it's like any other tissue which is caused to die by negligence, and the rights then flow in the same as any other injury action. It doesn't have to be complicated, and you don't have to change any of the law that you've already stated.
Mr. Nagel, maybe it seems to me we're getting a feel of this case. As I understand the claim here, you have asserted a cause of action on behalf of the Sepulvedus for loss of tissue that the mother experienced as a result of the negligence of the doctor in this case.
Right.
This is not a case where you are claiming recovery for injuries to the to the tissue that was lost.
That's right, I'm not.
You're claiming recovery to the person that lost the tissue.
Exactly.
So this is not a discussion about recovery for the lost baby. This is simply a discussion about an individual, a patient, who claims to have lost part of her body as a result of the negligence of the medical practitioner.
Thank you for stating it as clearly as you did.
Okay.
Even if we characterize this case as Justice Enoch has characterized it, which you have agreed, bottom line is the damages result from the death of the fetus. And we said repeatedly that you cannot recover damages for the loss of a fetus. Any way you slice it, the damages here is a result of the death of the fetus. And we would have to change four or five cases that we've already outlined in order to get the result, in order to be consistent.
Well, the two aspects of that, Your Honor. One is that to be logically consistent between the death of a fetus because of negligence, because of malpractice, and injury to a fetus, which then lives and can bring the lawsuit, you have to do something. The illogic of it is becoming so acute that pretty soon you're going to have to do something. If this case goes on and another case comes before you, you're going to be faced with the same problem again. So you might as well, at this point, decide whether or not that logic is going to stand or cannot be supported. I submit that it cannot be supported. And the way to move in a situation that does not do violence to the language which you have used before is to stop calling this a fetus and talk about it as an unborn child or as a part of the tissue of the mother, and that the mother has been damaged because of the removal of that tissue, the death of that tissue, the necrosis of that tissue, as a consequence of negligence on the part of some medical provider, and that the normal damages which ordinarily flow from any negligence case would then apply. There is not a reason to say that this is so unique that the mother should not recover for it.
There are various kinds of tissue you can lose. You can scrape your elbow, and that's not so bad. And you could lose a toe, and maybe that's worse. You could lose a finger, and that's perhaps a lot worse. And then you could lose a more vital organ, like an eye or something, and that perhaps is even worse than that. When you argue a case for the loss of the fetus, it's not going to be just the loss of tissue, is it? Aren't you going to argue that you've lost, as you say, an unborn child?
You have.
And that's going to be the argument?
Undoubtedly. No question. But one of the things that I think that is important here is that if you allow this to stand, you have carved out an area where a malpractice goes without any responsibility on the part of the person doing the malpractice and causing what really is a disastrous injury to the mother, to the family, but to the mother particularly. So I think the court really, in going forward with the decisions that have been made, have brought you to this inconsistency where it is cheaper, it is without responsibility to kill an unborn child. It has responsibility flowing from it to injure it only enough to allow it to be born within the definition of a live birth, as the legislature has set it up, with the cord pulsing, even though there may not be any breath. And as a consequence...
You say responsibility, but you really mean accountability.
I'm sorry, thank you. Accountability. But no accountability for killing an unborn child, but unlimited accountability for causing damages which occur in my practice where the child is essentially left a vegetable for the rest of whatever life it might have after birth.
Which is basically the essence of Justice Kilgallen's dissent in Whitty.
Exactly. And I think that this court, in order to recognize what has happened in the past, I'm not sure how you would feel comfortable with it, but the decision I think has to be made that either you allow the doctors to go without accountability or you find a way so that the mothers and the fathers of these unborn children who die as a consequence of medical negligence, as this one did, have some right to recover for their loss.
Any questions? Thank you, Counsel.
First of all, let me point out that the plaintiffs here do sue not only for damages for Mrs. Sepulveda, but also for her husband. Even if you accept the plaintiff's reasoning in its entirety, I believe that this court still must affirm as to Mr. Sepulveda. They have not enunciated any theory at all under which damages would be recoverable by him. Second, I'd like to point out that the position that we've urged this court to take, which is consistent, I think, with the common law of the state, is not a radical position. It is a position that has been adopted by other states.
What is the justification for denying mental anguish damages if the child is stillborn, as opposed to allowing damages if the child is born alive but then dies?
to begin with, I'm not aware, to begin with, you have the Wrongful Death Act. The Wrongful Death Act is a statutory creature that allows those damages. And the question that was asked and the issue that was discussed, I believe, at the end of my opponent's argument, dealt with the idea that there is a wrong here and therefore there should be some recovery. Let me respond to that basic argument. I think there's two assumptions there, both of which are incorrect. The first assumption is that the law must provide some remedy for every conceivable wrong. This court, I think, has not done so and has recognized that that is not the obligation of the law. In Boyles versus Kerr, this court held that it would not allow recovery under the tort of negligent infliction of emotional distress. In Nelson versus Cruzan, the court held that there would be no recovery for wrongful life, a defective baby born alive. In Kramer versus Louisville, this court recently disallowed recovery for a lost chance of survival. You can make an argument in all of those cases, just as the plaintiffs make that argument here, that there is a wrong out there. But the point is that we have common law and we have statutes. And the law as it is enunciated and as it exists today simply does not provide recovery for every conceivable wrong. There's policy reasons for not doing that. Speculativeness of the damages. And secondly, the mere fact that at some point it becomes, if there is to be a policy change, and we would be talking about a basic policy change here, I think that becomes the obligation of the legislature rather than of this court. The legislature did, in response to a lack of a remedy in the common law for wrongful death, provide a remedy in the wrongful death statute. But that statute has not been interpreted by this court to cover this particular situation. The legislature, of course, if it chooses, if it desires to change the public policy of the state, can amend that statute, but it has not chosen to do so. And I believe that this court should leave any such change to the legislature rather than taking it upon itself to, in essence, create a new cause of action.
Could you briefly speak to the other holding in Whitty, which is that a child should not be considered a chattel, and therefore,
this court did hold that in Whitty that the child should not be considered a chattel, and again, it goes to the idea of property rights, that the mother has not lost a piece of property in this particular situation.
This is something that's valuable. I mean, in contrast to the rest of the opinion, which had a lot of citations and authority, that part of the opinion was just done with the sentence without any discussion, authority, rationale, citation to Old English.
But in fact, I'm not aware of any common law that would allow recovery on the basis of loss of property. That roughly is the argument. I think the common law of this state, consistent with the common law of certain other states, such as New York, simply does not allow recovery in this situation. Absent some independent physical injury to the mother, none of which has been alleged here, and in fact none of which I believe occurred, I simply don't believe that this is a remedy or a wrong for which the law provides relief. Thank
you. If it were an intentional tort, would it be different?
I don't think that this court needs to address that issue, but if it were an intentional tort, I think probably the same result would obtain, except to the extent that you can recover nominal damages for some intentional tort.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will now take a brief recess and return to the final argument.